Mr. President, it's a tremendous honor for the university and the law school. Welcome back.
It is good to be back. It is good to be back. As some of you may know, I actually spent 10 years teaching classes and seminars here, and it was really fun. And I missed it, and I thought, well, why don't I come back and say hi to everybody? And so there are a couple people I want to acknowledge because they helped to facilitate this. First of all, I want to thank Dean Miles for closing down the school, I guess, for a day. Thank you. Special acknowledgments for Jeff Stone and Doug Baird, who were great friends when I was teaching here and were partly responsible for having me actually take on some responsibility straight out of law school to mold the minds of students who were just barely younger than me. I know that because some of them I saw, and they all have gray hair now, which is a little troubling. We've got a terrific congressional delegation who's here, and I just want to acknowledge them. First of all, your outstanding senior senator from the great state of Illinois, Dick Durbin, is here. And we've got Congressman Bobby Rush, Congressman Danny Davis, Congressman Bill Foster, and Congressman Mike Quigley. We also have Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General of Illinois. And my former seatmate in Springfield when we were both in the state Senate together and is doing a terrific job. And I want to thank David, who I was joking before we came out, is one of the country's foremost constitutional experts and a nice guy. You guys are lucky to have him. In fact, when I was teaching here, I think that I stole his con law class for a while, and he graciously gave it up because despite the privilege of grading 60 or 70 blue books, he apparently thought it was important for me to have that privilege as well. So, you know, last thing I'll say by way of introduction. I had a chance to talk to some young people over in the overflow room, mostly students, and I just said to them that having now been in politics for quite some time, seeing what lawyers are capable of doing every single day, working on a whole range of issues that are of huge importance to our democracy and to our society, I hope that all the students here are excited about the incredible changes and good that you are going to be able to do when you get out of here. I know that sometimes the news feeds cynicism, and democracy at this moment seems particularly frustrating. But each and every day I see lawyers not that much older than you who are helping young people get an education, are making sure that consumers are protected, are helping to keep America safe, are ensuring that our healthcare system works for everybody, are helping to preserve the planet and fight against climate change. It is remarkable what you can do with your talents, and it doesn't always get a lot of publicity, but you can make a really meaningful difference. So one of the reasons I wanted to come back is to recruit you, to stay engaged, get involved, make a difference. It doesn't mean you have to run for office. It doesn't mean you even have to work for government. There are a lot of ways of serving, but I do hope that one of the things that you will take away from our discussion today and your extraordinary education here at the University of Chicago is the incredible high that you can get from serving this country. So, with that, what do you want to talk about, David?
Well,
Well, let me start back when you were here as a teacher. Now, you taught constitutional law, so you were thinking about the Supreme Court and thinking about the justices and what made someone a great justice or a successful justice. But you're in a different spot now.
Mm-hmm.
Has your thinking changed?
Surprisingly, not as much as you would have expected. Obviously, we're having a substantial argument in Washington right now about not just a particular judge, but also about the process of appointing judges to the federal courts and appointing nominees to the Supreme Court. And to get this out of the way, Merrick Garland is an extraordinary jurist who is indisputably qualified to serve on the highest court of the land. And nobody really argues otherwise. I mean, I just want to be clear here. If the question is qualifications and excellence, it is uniformly viewed by not just Democrats, but also Republicans, those who have served, lawyers, judges, legal scholars, members of the current Supreme Court, that he is as good of a judge as we have in this country right now. That he's fair, he's smart, he's objective, he's a consensus builder. He shows judicial restraint. He's appreciative of the unique role of the court, but also respectful of the role of the other branches of government. So no one has plausibly made an argument that this is not the kind of person we'd want on the Supreme Court. The question then becomes, why is it so hard for the guy just to get a hearing and a vote? And this speaks to what's happened generally when it comes to the process of appointing federal judges. It used to be that people read the Constitution and Article II powers fairly straightforwardly. It says the president shall make these nominations with the advice and consent of the Senate. And unless there was some sort of real problem with that judge's character or qualifications, it was fairly routine at every level, both at the district court level, the appellate court level, and the Supreme Court, that the person would be confirmed in short order. There'd be a hearing. People would ask the potential judge a question or two or five or ten. There'd be questionnaires. And once they had satisfactorily performed that process, then the Senate would vote. And it was presumed, it was understood that just as the president had a constitutional duty to make the appointment, that